This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The howls of the endangered red wolf are fading in northeastern North Carolina. Their populations have been trending downward, leading some to believe that without intervention from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they'll fall silent forever. Others say red wolves have created a local ecological disaster, and trying to restore their populations in the wild is futile. Over the years, this complex issue has generated strong and differing opinions on the program's effectiveness and how the situation should be handled. As the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wraps up its two-year review of the Red Wolf Recovery Program, they may determine in the coming weeks if they'll continue the conservation effort. Assistant Regional Director for Ecological Services for the Southeast Region, Leo Miranda, in 2014, expressed some skepticism after the review was announced.
We currently use the science to make the determination of if having a self-sustaining population of red wolves in eastern North Carolina is viable or not, given the hybridization with coyote issues, as well as climate change, sea level rise, that might be a big threat to the species.
The results of the review are expected in September. No one knows for sure what will happen to the remaining red wolves if the program is discontinued, but the idea that the species could become extinct in the wild without human intervention prompted a rally Tuesday at Festival Park on the Washington, North Carolina waterfront.
I'm here to support the effort to save the red wolves.
They're becoming extinct, and I think we should do everything we can to preserve them in the wild.
About 45 people held signs with pro-red wolf slogans and chanted, FWS, don't throw in the towel. Diversity is key. Let me hear you howl. Some of the messages were aimed at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service director.
FWS Director Dan, save red wolf. Yes, we can.
We want to show the Fish and Wildlife Service that people in North Carolina do support the wolf program, do support keeping it here.
Ron Sutherland is a conservation scientist with the nonprofit Wildlands Network.
I don't think they've been getting that message. We've been drowned out by some of the anti-wolf folks in recent years, and so we're trying to fight back a bit and show that people do support endangered species recovery, do support keeping wolves on the landscape.
The only place in the world where the wild red wolves are found is in Beaufort, Dare, Hyde, Terrell, and Washington counties. Their population hit an all-time high of about 130 back in 2005-2006. Since that time, their numbers have quickly dropped. In 2014, there was an estimated 90 to 110 red wolves in the wild. Now, only 40 to 60 remain. There are a number of reasons for red wolf mortality, including natural causes, vehicle strikes, poisoning, or gunshot. President of Pamlico Albemarle conservationist Attila Nimitz says he's concerned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will put the remaining wild red wolves in captivity.
And we think that there's no going back from that. Having a captive breeding program continues the genetics of the red wolf, but at the same time, the spirit and law of the Endangered Species Act is that there has to be wild populations. So they'd have to go back to the drawing board, and it's unclear when we would ever see wild red wolves again.
Some private landowners in northeastern North Carolina would prefer the Red Wolf Recovery Program be terminated.
They would be a fool to keep it going.
Marco Gibbs has lived in Englehard in Hyde County his whole life. He remembers when the first red wolves were released at the nearby Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge in 1987.
For some crazy reason, they think they can do it, but after 30 years here of this experiment, I think they say around $30 million or more of our taxpayer money. The program's a failure.
Gibbs blames the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for changing regulations in order to continue the program. He remembers being told that the red wolves would stay on refuge property and eat small mammals like possums and nutria. That, he says, turned out to be a lie.
They told us a lot of things about this wolf. Would not breed with wild dogs and coyotes, would not eat big game. Purpose of the collar was to keep it on the refuge. It would not pack. It would only have one or two in a litter. They've had a lot of litters with five and six.
And he's not the only one who wants to see the recovery programs end. Otis Clayton Jr. owns a 600-acre farm about a mile from the Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge.
That's where they released them, and I just got took over with the wolves and coyotes. I saw a lost cairn at 23 one night.
Clayton is a hunter and trapper as well. He says the red wolf has caused the population of coyotes to get out of hand.
if we were like other counties in the state, if we didn't have a red wolf, we would have coyote hunting at night, and we could better handle to keep them from being so thick. That night that I saw 25, I couldn't shoot them. It's against the law at the time because the red wolf is here.
To make matters worse, Clayton says red wolves and the increasing number of coyotes are decimating the wildlife around his property.
I have deer flocks and stuff. I feed the deer and try to increase the wildlife, have a better hunt there, and that just draws them. The more you feed deer and the quail, and that just makes a food plot for the wolves and the coyotes.
However, conservation scientist with Wildlands Network Ron Sutherland argues the red wolf helps bring balance to the food chain since it's a top predator. He says the argument that red wolves and coyotes are wiping out the wildlife is untrue.
We put out 22 wildlife cameras in the red wolf recovery area in 2015 with the idea of documenting what's out there in terms of the wildlife and trying to address some public concerns that the wolves and coyotes are causing some sort of wildlife disaster.
Over the course of a year, the cameras in the Alligator River and Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuges have collected more than 10,000 images.
And what we found is that the woods are full of wildlife in that area. It's the furthest thing from a wildlife disaster you can get to on the East Coast, I think. It's probably one of the best wildlife spectacles in the United States.
The Red Wolf Recovery Program was once a story of the successful reintroduction of a species declared biologically extinct in the wild. Nearly 30 years later, the mention of it conjures up passionate opinions and strong arguments for and against the red wolf. Still, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has the final word. They're set to announce whether they'll continue or end the program in September. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. There's a new photography exhibit coming to Oriental's History Museum next weekend. Noted landscape photographer, author, and cartoonist Tony Craig has traveled the back roads of North Carolina photographing old general stores. This collection of photographs will be on display starting Sunday, September 4th through the end of December. Mac McKee speaks with Tony Craig about his exhibit, Country Stores in North Carolina.
Tony, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal. How did you become interested in the history of the old country store in North Carolina? Did you grow up in this area?
I grew up near Charlotte in Albemarle, which is a pretty rural area. The way I became interested in the stores was that I had moved to California in my early 20s, right after college, to go to school in California to become an animator. But I sure did miss North Carolina, so I would make it a point to come back every summer to take a trip with my family to Atlantic Beach. And along that highway, Highway 24, I would pass all kinds of little mom-and-pop shops, country stores, gas stations, milling companies. And I just started thinking, I would like to take pictures of those. I really like Bob Timberlake's art. It kind of reminded me of home. I thought, I'd like to maybe try to paint some of these things sometime. So I just started taking pictures starting in 1993. Of all those places that I would pass on the highway.
Do you feel like your photo exhibit will be nostalgic for many of the people who see it? Because many of these country stores, according to my research, started in the late 19th century and basically stayed open up until the 1980s when the modern convenience store started making way here in eastern North Carolina.
I definitely think that it will bring back a feeling of nostalgia for a lot of people because there's still a lot of people around who went to those stores, and there's still some of them that are open that you can visit. I just received an email from a lady today who'd seen one of my paintings of an old store on Facebook, just out of the blue. That was my father-in-law's store. I'm so happy to see this painting today. Thank you so much. And what a really touching email to get that somebody had all those memories reawakened just from seeing one of the paintings I'd done.
How many of your paintings or photos come from eastern North Carolina, these old country stores?
In the show, I'd say that most of them, about 15 or so, are going to be from that area. You're going to see some Sunbeam trucks. You're going to see some milling companies. You're going to see some old stores. You'll see maybe some soda bottles of drinks that you might not have had for years and years and years because they just don't make those anymore.
What is the most meaningful photo to you in this exhibit? What's the story behind that most meaningful photo or painting?
a print of a painting I did of the Richlands Milling Company. Every summer I would take a picture of that milling company, and every summer, much like William Christianberry, who's another photographer, if people want to look him up, I would see that it would change drastically from year to year in terms of it falling apart and going away. And I thought, I'm glad I'm taking pictures of these things because they're not going to be around for much longer. And sure enough, I came around the corner one day, one summer, and the whole milling company had been razed and was just gone, just gone. The only thing left were the grain silos in the back. And the next summer, those were gone. So I just had a real connection to that place, and I don't know why, but I loved it so very much. So that'll be one of the paintings that'll be in the show.
The Old Country Store, of course, was a big social gathering place for such a long time, and I remember it quite well, from at least from the 1960s on up. Do you think a lot of folks, probably when they see your paintings will and your photos, do you think that they will get that feeling about how they reacted to when they were in those stores, either growing up or as young adults?
I wish that I could capture the smells the same way I could on the paintings as visuals, because they bring back such a memory too. But I think people really enjoy what they're going to see.
This event takes place at Oriental's History Museum. Now, that is on Broad Street in Oriental. That's September the 4th.
I'll be there. I've got a book about country stores in North Carolina. I'll be signing that afternoon, and hope to see everybody there.
It's also free, and for more information, all you have to do is check out the events page at publicradioeast.org.
I enjoy listening to Public Radio East to get the news and hear what's going on locally. It's a part of my morning commute where I get a lot of my information and keeps me up to date on things that are happening. I live in Greenville, North Carolina. I've been listening to Public Radio East for about 2 years. I moved here from Missouri. I like to listen to the Diane Rehm Show, one of my favorites. I enjoy listening to Public Radio East to get the news and hear what's going on locally. It's a part of my morning commute where I get a lot of my information and keeps me up to date on things that are happening. I'd encourage anyone to listen. It's great information. You know you can trust it. My name is Jake Simmons. I live in Greenville, North Carolina. I am Public Radio East.
Say there, has it been hot enough for you now? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll chat with author Ken Drews, who believes that shade is the new sun. Plus, put down those pruners and your fabulous phone calls.
You Bet Your Garden, Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock on PRE Public Radio East. News and ideas at 88.5 in New Bern, 88.1 in Greenville, from Kinston to Raleigh at 90.3, and at the coast at 91.5.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Last week, we talked about the fact that fall is the best time to plant trees, shrubs, and perennials in our area. We also talked about the steps we should take prior to planting. Now it's time to get down to the nitty-gritty details of digging holes. What, you say? Digging holes isn't rocket science, right? Well, digging the right hole can have a huge impact on your plant's success. So first, let's look at your plant. You always want to buy a plant that has nice, healthy roots with white tips on them. Always check for circling roots. Roots circle when a plant becomes pot-bound. You need to cut through the circling roots and break up the root system of root-bound plants. While you're at it, knock out as much of the bark-based nursery mix that the plant was growing in as possible. Nursery mix and garden soil do not behave the same way, so leaving a lot of nursery mix attached to the roots of the plant can make it harder for the plant to establish successfully. The nursery mix can stay too wet in heavy soils and can dry out too quickly in lighter soils. Now it's time to dig the hole. The hole should be dug 2 to 3 times the width of the root ball. This will loosen the soil so that the roots can easily move out and into the surrounding soil. But you only want to dig the hole no deeper than the depth of the root ball. When you're done, the tree or shrub should be planted so that the junction between the first root and the trunk is right at or an inch above soil level. I asked you to dig away at the nursery mix if necessary to find the topmost root, because it's not uncommon for trees and shrubs to be planted too deeply at the nursery. If you don't address that now, it will be an issue down the road for the tree. The saying is, plant them low, they'll never grow. Plant them high, they'll reach for the sky. Make sure you fill the planting hole with native soil. Do not add compost, garden soil, or other amendments directly to the planting hole. And do not prune at planting time. This can actually cause more harm than good, as the plant is losing important carbohydrate stores and leaves during an already stressful time. Trees only need to be staked or guyed if they cannot support themselves. And remember that all guys and stakes should be removed after 1 year to prevent them from growing into the bark of the tree. Mulch around the tree or shrub and up to the root ball, but do not mulch up against the trunk. This can promote the development of girdling roots. Water every few days for the first few weeks, and then cut down to once a week through the first season if there is no rainfall. It takes most trees 2 to 3 years to become fully established. Small trees establish more quickly and often outperform larger trees over the long run, so take that into consideration when you purchase your plant. The first year it sleeps, the second year it creeps, the third year it leaps, is the saying for trees. Perennials and small shrubs will establish more quickly. Fall is coming on quickly, so go out, take a look around, and plan to plant for success this year.
The National Park Service is celebrating their National Park Centennial by encouraging you to explore your park. For those of us in eastern North Carolina, that means a trip to Cape Lookout National Seashore. As some incentive, they're waiving entrance fees at all of their parks this weekend, including Cape Lookout. Superintendent Pat Kenny says they have a variety of special programs planned.
So on Sunday, from 9:30 to 12:30, folks can go on a trip with a ranger called Beach Birding with a Side of Horses. And the rangers will take you out on a hike around Shackelford on the western end of Shackelford, focusing on all the great birds that come to Shackelford Banks and spend time on the beach and in the area there. And then, of course, the wild horses around Shackelford.
If you make it to Cape Lookout this weekend, expect a crowd. In addition to the centennial celebration, the park is experiencing an uptick in visitation this season because it was named the best national park beach by USA Today in March.
It's very exciting to win that recognition. We actually received an email from USA Today advising us that we won.
Cape Lookout beat other national park beaches in Virgin Islands National Park, Cape Cod National Seashore, and Olympic National Park. An honorable mention from the contest includes nearby Cape Hatteras National Seashore and the number 8 spot. Kenny is actually quite humble about the designation, saying the contest is a win for the national park system as a whole, bringing greater visibility to the places they protect.
Obviously, it's great to be recognized as the best, but I think, again, all the national park beaches that were on the list present great opportunities for the public to see some of the special resources this country has.
For many, visiting the park is nostalgic, pulling up your boat on shore, swimming all day with a lighthouse and Carolina blue skies as the backdrop. For others, the 56 miles of pristine coastline provides a respite far away from the hustle and bustle of life. Whatever the reason, the National Seashore is a popular beach destination with about 500,000 visitors annually, some arriving by passenger ferry, others by private boat. Kenny says there's no shortage of activities to do on the three barrier islands that make up the park.
Some of the best surf fishing around. It is a great place to collect shells and beach comb. It's a great place just to come sit and read a book and enjoy the spectacular views. We have a lot of people that camp and walk and fish and swim and surf. So there's a whole range of activities you can do in Cape Lookout.
Another unique attraction is climbing 207 stairs to the top of the Cape Lookout Lighthouse. Built in 1859, the black and white diagonally checkered structure holds a rotating beacon that's operational both day and night. The light flashes every 15 seconds and is visible up to 19 miles at sea. At 163 feet, the lighthouse is one of the tallest structures on the Crystal Coast, where people can take in panoramic views of the mostly undeveloped shoreline.
Climbing the lighthouse is probably one of the highlights for many folks that come to the park. It not only gives you a glimpse into the history of the area, but I'll tell you, that view from the top is pretty spectacular. You can take in the whole, 360 view from the top of the lighthouse. You see the cape, see the bight, you can see the surrounding islands, and then you get that spectacular unobstructed view out into the ocean.
The lighthouse opens for tours from the second week in May to the third weekend in September. Climbing takes place Tuesdays through Saturdays from 9:45 to 4:15, with groups leaving every 15 minutes. Another unique feature about Cape Lookout National Seashore is that you can drive a vehicle or ATV on the beach.
Two of the three islands are open to beach driving. We get a lot of visitors that come and take advantage of that, and they use it as a way to travel up and down the beach and get to various spots to camp or fish or to take care of, just to enjoy one of their national parks.
Speed limits on North Core Banks and South Core Banks are posted and enforced. During certain times of the year, there may be closures to protect bird and sea turtle nests. Most people come to Cape Lookout for a day at the beach, but those who stay longer will be rewarded with a beautiful sunset and a dark night sky to look for shooting stars and constellations.
If you've never spent the night at the Cape, I think that's one of the most spectacular things about it, is you get to see that really dark sky. It is a rural community down here in eastern North Carolina. Get away from that city light, and you get out at the Cape, and the stars are just amazing.
There are no designated campgrounds on the seashore, but primitive tent camping is permitted along much of the beach without a permit. Whatever activities you have planned, Kenny hopes people in eastern North Carolina will get outside this weekend and explore their park. For more information, visit our events calendar at publicradioeast.org. The Twin Rivers Artists Association is having an interactive art critique. You can bring your unfinished object of art, and speaker Katie Wiggs will help you solve the problem. The program is open to visitors, artists, and art lovers.
My name is Eileen Rowe, president of Twin Rivers Artists Association. Katie Wiggs is a visual artist. She has a degree in art education from East Carolina University. She is going to be doing what we call an interactive member art critique, where our members are asked to bring a piece of art that they either finished quite some time ago and just aren't happy with it, or a piece that they might be in the middle of and can't figure out why it doesn't seem to be clicking. Katie will spend a few minutes with as many people as we can cover in about an hour and a half. It's a very relaxed atmosphere, and most everyone knows each other. We have new members that are welcome. We have our meetings the first Wednesday of every month, so September 7th, at the Bank of the Arts, 6:30. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org events calendar.
I volunteer at Public Radio East because I enjoy the radio station and I wanted to help them succeed. I've been a volunteer at Public Radio East for 5 or 6 years, and some of the things I do as a volunteer are mailings, where I stuff envelopes, and I participate in the annual fund drive, answering telephones. I also help file the discs after the programs have run. It's extremely interesting. I have a lot of fun working with the people here. They're enjoyable. We all have a good time. I would think that anyone that wanted to help support this radio station would be interested in helping us with our volunteer work, because that helps free up funds for programming. My name is Helen Parker, and I'm a Public Radio East volunteer.
For more information on becoming a Public Radio East volunteer, call 800 202-222-9832. And thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at our website, publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.